You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Delighted to have you here today. I'm Ken Lieberthal. I'm director of the John L. Thornton China Center at Brookings. It's a particular pleasure to introduce this event today, in part because I've known Professor Huang Gang for many years, and it's just a joy to be able to welcome here to my place for him to give a presentation. But also because Brookings is all about doing high-quality research, research that has an impact in the real world. And this is actually the first of three book events we're putting on here in the coming, in a one-week period. This one today with Professor Hu, and then one for Jonathan Pollack, who did a wonderful book on North Korea that will be this Friday. And then next Wednesday afternoon, a book that I wrote on managing the China challenge. Each of those provides an opportunity to hear from the author and then hear commentators and then ask questions of all of them. So it's the kind of thing we love to do, and to have three in 1 week is really a great pleasure on our end. We've got a terrific program today. Professor Huang Gang is one of China's most wide-ranging and influential public intellectuals. It is remarkably true to say that, and I've noticed this over many years, what he says is often not the conventional wisdom. But if you wait 5 to 10 years, it is mainstream policy in China. He has had a remarkable ability to raise issues that are ahead of the curve and take 5 to 10 years before they move to the center of what China is doing. So I've always paid great attention to what he says about the future. And his book that he'll be discussing today is about China in 2020. Dr. Hu is the director of the Center for Chinese Studies and professor at the School of Public Policy and Management at Tsinghua University. His book on China in 2020, by the way, copies are available outside for purchase if you didn't notice on the way in. His book is actually the second in a series that the Thornton China Center is publishing under the direction of Cheng Li, who is one of our commentators today. The idea of the series is to bring the writings of some of China's most important public intellectuals into an English platform where they can be widely understood by English audiences. The first of these was by Professor Yu Keping, called On Democracy. Democracy. I knew I had gotten that wrong. Democracy is a good thing. It's a good thing you were here to correct me. Professor Hu's book is the second. We have the third and fourth books already lined up. So this is an ongoing series, and it's terrific to be able to do this event around this book today. Professor Hu is a prolific writer. In fact, for those of you who have the book, if you turn to the final five pages of the book, the final five pages is simply a list of the books that he has published. Okay, my list of books fits on one page quite nicely, but anyway. This book is remarkably comprehensive in scope in assessing China's future, in that way very reflective of the multidisciplinary approach that Dr. Hu has taken over the years. We therefore have two commentators who will approach it from distinctly different disciplinary backgrounds. It's a real honor to welcome Nicholas Lardy from across the street at the Peterson Institute. Nick is probably, he's certainly one of America, I'll be diplomatic, one of America's foremost economists dealing with China. And then secondly, Cheng Li. Cheng is senior fellow at Brookings and director of research at the Thornton China Center. Dr. Hu will take about 30 minutes for his remarks. Each of our commentators will take 10 to 15 minutes. We'll then have, I suspect, 30 minutes or a little more than that for Q&A in the audience. I'll ask each of the speakers to simply come up in turn. When it comes time for Q&A, I'll remind you of this, but please just keep in mind, when you're recognized, state your name and your affiliation. Ask a question that ends in a question mark. Please, when you're recognized, first of all, wait for our roving microphone to come to you and then do all of that so that everyone can hear you. The one last comment I'd make is that I want to thank Professor Hu for agreeing in advance to put all of his slides, make all of his slides available. We will have them on our website at Brookings under the Thornton Center within a very short period of time after this presentation. With that done, Professor Hu, welcome.
Sakio invited me to give a brief introduction for my book. The title is China in 2020, A New Type of the Superpower. I prepared for the PPT more than four pages. I quickly to give a conclusion. Today we need to address some of the questions not only the China side interesting, but also Western, even the world are very interesting. So I quickly gave agenda my presentation. Firstly, I talked to China as a emerging superpower, economic development, demographic challenges, health problem, even the education and human resources, science, technology, and innovation, climate change, even the sustainable growth. This covers all the China problem, even the tendencies. Last point, gave my ideas by 2020. What's China development goals? What's grand strategy we achieve them. Firstly, I gave the talk related to China emerging superpower. I called the China last 60 years take the several summer rapidly increase, especially since 1978, the China quite extends into the rank of the great power, not only after stripped expectation of the international community, but also far surpassed the Chinese government own expectation, even including my expectation. How to analyze the China rising of the modern China? We are based on the national development life cycle. First stage, I called the preparation for the modern economic stage. Second stage, I called the high speed growth stage. That means a takeoff. This is the idea 20 years ago. We recognized after 1980, the China will be takeoff. The third stage, that means from 2020 to the 2050, even the 2060, and so on. We call the steady, the growth stage. This curve based on the medicine's data base described the China unique. The curve we call the experiencing the U curve since 1820. The China account for 1/3 decline to until the 1950. After then, the increase, especially last 30 years, even based on the medicine's forecast by 2030, the China will be take over the U.S., even the Europe, Western Europe. This is based on medicine's analysis. This is my analysis resources, sources of the economic growth, including the capital stock, employment, human capital, and TRP, total fertility productivities. I think that China has a potential for the future economic growth. This is including, I call the international catch-up and the domestic catch-up. That means between the coastline and the inland, like a rich, like a Shanghai, Beijing, and poor the province, Guizhou. This is where we can use the catch-up effects. Second, the high domestic savings, even the high investment rate, including FDI. Third, expected increase the human capital, I will be mentioned. The growth of the non-agriculture sectors, the increase the total factor productivity, TIP, maintain 3%, even the 4%. This is my estimate in my book. We are describing the China how to catch up, even to take over the U.S. This is by the last year, my estimate. This year, I gave added new information. This is describe the China where create 50 years economic growth golden age. That means since 1978 to the 2030. This is the new result. That means last 30 years, the China will be maintain 9.9 annual growth. Next 20 years will be reached to the 7.5%. The 50 years will be reached to the 9.0% for the annual growth. This is the very break American record, even the Japan record. If based on constant price, like the 1978 is 1.00. If we from the growth index to look at, in 2010, the China GDP over than 20 times. By the 2020, there will be over than 40 times. That means the China take 42 years since 1978 to the 2020. The GDP will be growth more than 40 times. If the continue next 10 years since after 2020, the China GDP will be more than 8 times. This is describe the I called the catch up index of the GDP. Like the US as 100. This is based on the medicines data. By 2020, the China will be about the 1.7 times that of the US. By 2030, more than the 2 times. This is the long-term tendency. I put information. This is describe the catch-up index in term of the GDP per capita. We find it the China now is about one of the third of that of the U.S. Based on the PPP. If the by 2030 will be reached to the half, nearly the half of the that U.S. if we look at the exchange rate approach based on current U.S. dollar, we find that the last 10 years, the China quickly narrow gap between U.S. and China and between the Japan, even the and the China from 8 time decline to last year, especially as you know, the international financial crisis reduced to 2.5. If based on our estimate, including three factors. One is China real growth will be reached to nearly the 8%, even the between the 8% to the 9%. Second factor we call the our nominal GDP reflects the deflator. The third means exchange rate appreciation rate is about the 4%. By 2020, the China will be take over the U.S. This is based on the exchange rate mentioned above it. But the same conclusion, like my book said, the China take over the U.S. in the term of the GDP, regardless of the how it is calculated, is inevitable. I call this is the last, I call the term to describe the China how to catch up, even take over the U.S. since 2000. We need to take not only 10 years, 20 years, even the more years. This is the first time to recognize the China economic traditions and the influence. The second, as you know, the demographic challenge, especially this time, published the national census. We find that the China need to respond the aging society, even a few children legislation. The very important information from my book mentioned about it, the urbanization is mind-driving force for the future development. I called, this is based on my book, calculated. If based on a new the population census last year's, like a red color I describe, but in last year, the China urban population reached to over than 600 million. If based on this baseline, we forecast by 2020, the China will be reached to more than 800 million. By 2030, will be reached to 1 billion. That means the China share of the urban population in world total will be from now 19% reached to the 22%. If we look at the health, the China face a lot challenge. My book gave some the information. I quickly to mention about it. Another indicators like the HDI Human Development Index. What's meaning of the China building up Xiaokang society, even the well off society? We are based on the HDI. In 1950, China belonged to extremely low of the HDI. In 1980, the China into the low middle level of the HDI. 2010, the China nearly the I call the high HDI level. By 2020, the China will be increase its HDI. This is the indicators including life expectancy index, education, even the GDP. This is actually why 12-5-year program first time introduced health indicators as a very important quantity indicators. This is related what meaning of the Xiaokang society. This my estimate the China human resources are the results. If I did new data last year, the China average education year for the adults reached to the 9 years. I estimate by 2030, the China will be reached to the 11 years. This is coefficient we call the catch-up index of the China and the, with the U.S. In 1950, the China just only equal to U.S. 12%. But last year, very quickly to catch up. By 2030, will be narrow between the China and the U.S., even the between the China and the developing countries human capital development. This is described the China how to become a global human resources. I gave a definition of the human resources. That means population age from 15 to the 64 years time average year of education to calculate the China and other countries a share of the world total. The education, not only the education, we need to understanding even the matter in the science and technology of power. This is based on my book, gave a very clear the, ideas how to give a quantitative analysis, calculate, even make an international comparison. This is our estimate last year's. We found the gap between the U.S. and China, between the Japan and the China gap rapidly declined. Today I introduce my new research. This year we estimated. I always corrected my original research. This table describes how do matter of the science and technology are power. I chose five the indicators, including the scientists and engineering engaged in the R&D, R&D expenditure based on the PPP, international paper published. This is based on the World Bank, even the Web of the Science by the Reut, Thomas Reut database, patent application, high-tech export. This is the five indicators we calculate. We find it. I'm very surprised that China quickly to narrow the gap between the U.S. and China from 6.4 times in 1980. Now decline to quickly to reduce to 1.2. This table tells us the China quickly, I use my five major indicators, to take over the, U.S. This is, describe the China was, driving force of the China rising in the science and the technology. I gave the detailed information in my book, including the economic and the science technology globalization. The business sector now take a more very important role for the R&D expenditure, even the innovation and so on. Government guideline and the promote sustainable high-speed economic growth. The China where in advance realize the government target by 2020 China as innovative the country some I call the four quantity indicators. The China will be face the biggest challenge I call the climate change and sustainable development because the China is worst victim country. I have another special book published in 1997 analysis, natural disaster, and China economic development. But now, the China quickly become number one, even the superpower, in the greenhouse gas emission. The China need to shift their own pattern or model. I call it how to from big the black cat shift to big the green cat. We call the sixth generation of the cat series. We need to initial or participate in a green industry revolution to promote innovation, green technology, to promote green demand or green consumption, even the green energy. Remark. This is the first time a 25-year program accept green development, these new ideas, as a very important policy for the next 5 years, even the next 20 or 30 years. So what's the goal of the development and the grand strategy in the next 10 years, even the in the future? I called we need to address four basic principles. This is the ideas I come from the not only for my research, even the other some colleagues, even the leaders' ideas. I combine this. I call the this is the socialist modernization by 2030. We gave some quantitative indicators to want to design the roadmap to the reach 2020 target. This is a lot roadmap. The last questions we need to understand it. If the China become the superpower, what kind of the new type of the superpower? I address several points. Firstly, China should not be a superpower that takes the hegemony and dominate. Secondly, the China rising has been defined by the peaceful development. The third should be resources, efficiency, environmentally friendly superpower. That means we promote green development, create a new pattern of the production, consumption, even the trade. The China should be a superpower with human, high human development levels. That means catch up the U.S. Education levels, even the university, and the small gap between the rich and poor. The China should also be superpower with significant soft power resources. The China must be neutral and the responsibility more and more to supply the accord not only regional public goods, even the global public goods. So we really are thinking about China a dream. Even Chairman Mao in 1956, even the Hu Jintao 2007 talk a lot the China dream. I think besides it's China's enormous economic and trade contribution, as well as poverty reduction contribution for the last 30 years. But in the future, the China need to contribution for other key areas. Firstly, we call the human development. Secondly, science and the technology, even the knowledge contribution. The third, green movement or green contribution. Last one, culture, the contribution. These four contributions would represent China's modern renaissance with domestic and international significance. Given that China has become one of the largest stakeholders in the world affairs today, it is incumbent upon it not only to follow its own interest and the interest of the developing country, but also to develop in fashion consistent with the interest of the developing country. Thank you very much.
I'm delighted to join this program to celebrate the publication of Huang Gong's book. I think it's fairly clear, if you've had a chance to look at the book or familiar with his work, that he's really moved, unlike the specialization that we see in modern economics, certainly in the U.S. and many other places, he's working in the fields of demography, public health, income distribution, environmental studies and climate change, science, technology, and innovation, and many, many others. He's really a Renaissance man rather than kind of a narrow specialist. What I want to talk about today is this view that China is in this currently, this stage of high-speed growth that Huang Gong dates starting in roughly 1980 and will continue for about another decade. And certainly the first two decades have been a huge success, at least in measured in terms of the headline growth numbers that we've seen over the last two decades. So what I want to talk about is what I see as the greatest challenge to sustaining this growth path for the next decade so that China can get to the stage that starts in 2020, which I believe he calls the kind of steady state growth, which is still fairly rapid by global standards, but a somewhat slower pace of growth than we would have seen in the first three decades from the beginning of economic reform, roughly in 1980. And the thing I think is the greatest challenge is something that economists call financial repression. And I'm going to talk first about what is this. I'm going to talk secondly about what the consequences are, and then I'm going to talk about the implications for the prospects that China will continue this high-speed growth over the next decade. Well, financial repression can be measured in a lot of different ways, but I think the most important is that financial repression is an economic system that is characterized by what I would call ultra-low interest rates. And ultra-low interest rates have many, many important implications, but among the most important are that it transfers income and wealth from savers to borrowers. So they're transferring wealth from the household sector, which is the big depositor into the banking system, to the corporate sector, which is the biggest borrower from the banking system. And equally important, these very low interest rates transfer income from households to banks, because very low deposit rates provide banks with a very cheap source of funding and allow them to be potentially quite profitable. Just to put some numbers on it, if we look at this from the point of view of deposit rates, before 2004, and I date the onset of financial repression roughly from the beginning of 2004, prior to 2004, for a period of 7 or 8 years, the average real interest rate on a one-year deposit was about 3%. That is, if you took the nominal interest rate and adjusted it for consumer price inflation, if you put your money consistently into one-year CDs, you would have earned 3% after inflation. Since the beginning of 2004, over the next the seven-year period, the real interest rate on one-year deposits on average has been minus 0.3. So households are not earning anything from the money they put in the bank. They're getting taxed at a very significant rate. And it's important to note that these low interest rates are not a function of the recent environment where we have ultra-low interest rates because many governments are trying to promote expansion of the economy to come out of the global recession. This has been a fairly consistent pattern in China, even during the supercharged growth rates that China had in, say, 2005, 2006, and 2007. We can also look at it from the point of view of lenders, borrowers. If you're going to borrow money from the banking system, how much does it really cost? And I'm going to do this kind of from the corporate perspective. And so the real lending rate is the nominal rate minus the price, you know, the prices of machinery and equipment, the kinds of things that a corporate borrower is going to use the money for. Prior to 2004, the average one-year real lending rate was about 6.8%. Since the beginning of 2004, on average, it has been 1.7%. So if you're a borrower, money has become, in the corporate sector, money has become very cheap. So that's what financial repression is. And this has been achieved because the central bank, of course, sets the interest rates on both the deposit side and the lending side. So this isn't determined by supply and demand in the money market, but is more determined by, is really directly determined by the central bank. So the second question is, what are the consequences when you have financial repression? Well, I think it's fairly easy to anticipate. The first thing you have is that investment will rise as a share of GDP. If I think the Chinese economy is pretty much a market economy, and that borrowers are looking at the rate of return on projects that they can undertake, and they're not going to borrow a lot of money if the return on the potential projects is substantially less than it's going to cost them to borrow the money. So when you can borrow money for 1.7 instead of 6.8, you're going to do a lot more borrowing, and the rate of investment is going to go up in the economy. And that's certainly true. That's what happened in China. Prior to 2004, the average rate of investment, this is in capital formation as a share of GDP, was roughly in the mid-30% range, pretty high compared to many emerging markets, but not really very high compared to the newly industrialized countries in East Asia in their high growth periods, countries like Japan from the mid-50s to the mid-80s, Taiwan from the late 60s, and so forth, Korea. They also had investment rates that were in the mid-30% on average. But since 2004, China's investment rate has averaged 44% and has been rising fairly persistently over this period and reached 49% last year, which is absolutely unprecedented in global economic history. So when you have cheap capital, the investment rate goes up. We've seen a substantial increase in manufacturing investment, and essentially capital is being subsidized, and when you subsidize something, you get more of it. So the predictable result is that we have gotten more goods of the type that use capital intensively. And what that means in China is that the manufacturing share of GDP has actually risen since 2004 and is now very, very high compared to other countries at comparable levels of economic development. China's at about 33% on manufacturing, narrowly defined. And the average, according to the World Bank, for the comparable set of countries is about 21%. So we've gotten a very outsized manufacturing establishment that has been financed with the cheap capital that has emerged since 2004. The second reason that we have gotten a big increase in investment as a share of GDP is the actions of the household sector. As I mentioned, the household sector, when it puts money in the bank, has been seeing it diminish in real terms since 2004. And the response to that has been for households to put more and more of their money into residential investment. Property prices have been averaging an increase of close to double digits over the last decade. So in the earlier period, you got a positive return on your money. You kept quite a bit of your assets in bank deposits. More recently, people have put more and more of their money into housing. Prior to 2004, China was investing about 3.5% of GDP in residential housing. Since 2004 up to the present, it's gone up to an average of about 7%. It's still rising. It was 9% last year. Now, the reason households do this, of course, is in part some of the other features of a highly repressed financial system. It not only means no low interest rates, but it also means that you have a very, shall we say, underdeveloped financial sector. No capital account convertibility. In other words, a very narrow range of financial assets. No capital account convertibility, so you can't put your money abroad. So households are faced with a choice basically of putting their money in the bank or putting their money into real assets, which in China, of course, increasingly has meant housing. So The first consequence of the financial repression that has emerged since 2004 is a sharply rising rate of investment into unprecedented territory, a sharp increase in the manufacturing share of GDP to a very elevated level compared to peer group type countries, and a very substantial increase in investment in residential housing. Another consequence is that there has been a slowdown in the expansion of the non-agricultural labor force. In the 7 or 8 years before 2004, the non-agricultural labor force, which is the modern sector labor force, was growing at about 3% per year. Beginning in 2004 up to the present, it's been growing at about 2.7% per year. This is because investment has been tilted into manufacturing. Manufacturing is less labor-intensive than services. Investment has moved away from the service sector. That's why it's relatively has become relatively small. The service share in China is about 40% of GDP. In the peer group countries, it's about 54% of GDP. So China's manufacturing sector has become unusually large. Its service sector is unusually small. And the most important thing is that the wage share of GDP, as opposed to the share of GDP accruing to the corporate sector or to the government, has gone down, not because real wages haven't been going up. I think real wages in recent years, not just in recent years, but for at least a decade, have been going up by around 8 or 9% per year. But the growth of the labor force has slowed down, so the wage share of GDP has grown more slowly. So I think the consequences of financial repression, there are some others that we could talk about, but the consequences of financial repression are this rising share of investment, more of it going into housing, slowdown in the growth of employment, the development of an outsized manufacturing sector, and an underdeveloped service sector. Now, what are the implications for China? Angang makes a very eloquent argument in his book for what he calls Chinese exceptionalism. But he is talking purely in geopolitical terms that China's rise will be different from some of the experiences we've seen in earlier decades and centuries. And I tend to think that's a very good argument. But as an economist, I am of the view that there is not going to be exceptionalism. I think the consequences of having this highly elevated level of investment will be adverse for China in the long run because it's really not sustainable. And the transition to less investment necessarily involves investment growing at a slower rate than the underlying economy, and that transition will be extremely challenging. We've seen other countries that have been grappling with that, countries like Japan in the 1990s and even in the past decade. I think the risk is that slowdown of investment will be initiated in the property sector, where we've had substantial overinvestment. When the price correction comes, we will have a substantial negative wealth effect that will have a big effect on economic development in China. The share of household wealth represented by housing for urban households has more than doubled over the last 10 years, most of the increase occurring since 2004. And as housing prices decline, there'll be a negative effect on household wealth, which will have a negative effect on household consumption. So the risk is of a substantial prolonged slowdown in GDP growth as part of the transition to moving towards a more sustainable level and share of investment in China's underlying economy. I'm not forecasting that this will happen. I think it's uncertain, but I think this is the biggest challenge that I think remains to China sustaining the kind of high-speed growth that Angang is talking about for the remainder of this decade. Thank you.
G.H. Wells, the brilliant science fiction novelist, once said, I quote, "History is a race between education and catastrophe." This is particularly true for the 21st century, in which we confront many potentially global catastrophes, and some of which can be a result of dreadful misunderstandings and misperceptions. Now, this is a time when education, vision, and international thinking are greatly needed. We are delighted to have Professor Huang Gang, a great educator, a Chinese visionary, and a strategic thinker, to share his perspectives and his insights. I feel particularly privileged over the past year and also to closely work with Professor Hu, and also today discuss the book with you, Ken, Nick, and our audience. Now, as Ken mentioned earlier, Professor Hu's book, China in 2020, is part of Brookings Institution's Southern Chinese Thinker series, initiated by an American visionary and happened to be Brookings board chair, John Thornton, and with the intellectual guidance of Ken Liebesow. The project or book series has been motivated by the fact that the English language or English language studies of present-day China have not adequately informed a Western audience of the dynamism of the debates within China and the diversity of views concerning its own future. In such a sharply changing or rapidly changing and complex world, it would be enormously helpful or valuable for the decision makers of foreign policies and the analysts in the outside world to broaden our perspective by developing a more sophisticated knowledge and understanding of how Chinese intellectuals perceive and debate about their own future. Now, I hope that the readers will find, as I do, that Huang Gang's volumes, rich empirical data, explanation of the indigenous Chinese concepts, and the thought-provoking arguments concerning China's rise make it invaluable for understanding China's important role in our world. Now, as a discussant, I would like to make two sets of comments on what I believe the two themes that emerged in the volume. The first is what I call Chinese optimism, and the second is the Chinese exceptionalism. On the first, Professor Hu holds his characteristically optimistic view that China will continue its high-speed economic growth in the next decade and beyond due to a combination of factors. Now, these factors include the country's solid industrial foundation, newly built world-class infrastructure, high rates of investment savings and foreign investment, large domestic market, human resources advantages, and last but certainly not least, the country's commitment to transitioning towards a domestic demand-driven and environmentally friendly mode of economic growth. Now, as Professor Hu argues, by 2020, China will likely not only surpass the United States as the largest economy in the world, but also because of its accomplishments in education, innovation, and clean energy, will emerge as a mature, responsible, and attractive superpower. This is the three adjectives he used, mature, responsible, and attractive superpower. Now, as for the second major theme, Professor Hu acknowledged that the prevailing wisdom in the Western literature or Western scholarship on international relations holds the view that emerging superpower will destabilize the existing international system due to zero-sum competition with the existing superpower over spheres of influence, natural resources, market access, and the military superiority. But Professor Hu believes that China's rise to superpower status will be an exception rather than the norm, or exception rather than the rule. Now, he means that the China will be a new type of superpower. Professor Wu observes that in an increasingly interdependent world, China has neither the resources nor the intention to replace the United States and become the sole leader in the world. Rather, China needs to cooperate with the United States in order to cope with global challenges in economics, politics, energy, and environment. Now, let me directly comment on these two themes, and specifically to highlight my reservation about Huanggang's optimistic thinking about China's economic future, and also my view of why we should take Huanggang's Chinese exceptionalism very seriously. First, I'm more critical, and for second, I think we should think it very, very seriously. Now, the first, my reservation about the Chinese optimism, which is strongly endorsed by Professor Wu's book. I understand the various reasons for which Professor Wu has been optimistic, you know, about China's economic future. There's a long list of reasons. And Professor Wu's optimism certainly is strengthened by the fact that pessimistic assessment of China have repeatedly proved to be wrong during the past two decades. There's numerous such kind of pessimistic forecasts. Now, for example, this year marks the 10th anniversary of China's accession to WTO. Only a few years ago, many Western analysts believed that China's accession to the WTO would inevitably cause major upheaval to its state-owned enterprises, including its state-owned commercial banks. This cynical view was understandable because 10 years ago, bad bank loans account for 40% of the capital, 40% of the China's state-owned commercial banks, as whose book also mentioned. 10 years later, in 2009, however, the percentage of the bad loans was reduced to 2 to 3%. Most interestingly, of the top 10 banks in the world in terms of market capitalization, in 2009, that of these 10 top banks, four of them are Chinese banks, including number one, number two, and number three. As of 2009, of the world's 10 largest container ports, six were located in the PRC, including Shanghai, Hong Kong, Shenzhen, Guangzhou, Ningbo, and Qingdao. Now, two decades earlier, in 1989, none of the PRC ports was among the top 20. These examples show China's growing power as a financial, trade, and a transportation giant at the present and its future. Yet, I have a number of reservations with Professor Hu's optimistic thinking about China's economy. Lately, I have been disturbed by the widely shared sentiment in China among many Chinese intellectuals that sounds like China's growth could continue for a long time, never realize or fully appreciate or understand that no country's rise, you know, is really linear, could be go down. But this kind of sentiment really bothers me. And also, in fact, I deeply worry about the three major issues, problems in Chinese economy, namely the property bubble, inflation, and also state monopoly. But my main concern actually not lies in the economic arena, but lies in the political bottleneck. Now, Huanggang rightly argues that China should make a transition toward a domestic demand-driven and environmentally friendly mode of economic growth, which differs profoundly from the cheap labor, high energy consumption, high environmental cost mode of growth, which dominated China's growth for the past three decades. Now, if we read Professor Hu's book, you will see three phrases frequently appear. One is technological innovation. The second is the service sector, the importance of service sector. The third is soft power. But in my view, technological innovation requires political freedom more than anything else. Requires sense of openness and requires the political tolerance and creativity and heterogeneity. Now, service sector also, as Nick mentioned, that really has some troubles. They differ from the manufacturing development because service sector requires more trust, requires more rule of law, which in my view are also quite weak. And finally, the soft power, and I believe that ultimately, based on a mature civil society, which in my view, during the past 2 or 3 years, China really not promoting that area. So I think that political bottleneck will prevent China's next phase of economic growth in a profound way. Besides, there will be some other political challenges, you know, in the wake of leadership succession next year. Now, my second comment on Huanggang's Chinese exceptionalism. Foreign analysts of China will, of course, not be so naive to take Professor Wu's arguments at face value. Many of Professor Wu's propositions reflect on an ideal rather than reality. And they are probably understood to be well-intended aspirations and promises rather than predetermined conditions or inevitable prospects. Chinese exceptionalism, like Chinese optimism, has a large number of domestic critics in China. They actually, my introductory chapter really outlined the criticism of Huanggang in both accounts within China. Now, it is important to note that the Chinese assessments of the PRC's quest for the superpower status and its implications for peace and prosperity in the world are as diverse or controversial in China as elsewhere. But foreign analysts or foreign decision makers should not be too quickly to discount the significance of Professor Hu's arguments or analysis. In a way, Professor Hu actually proposes a comprehensive strategic framework for Chinese decision makers to guide the next stage of China's rise, seeking to maximize the country's positive impact on the world and minimize the negative effects of its rapid development, which he believes that also serve the best interest for China. Now, Professor Wu believes that the Chinese leadership's emphasis on domestic development will likely continue as the country puts priority on policies that address economic disparities, the lack of public health care, energy efficiency, and ecological challenges. Now, this domestic-centric approach will prevent the country from pursuing an aggressive foreign policy, according to Professor Wu. The development of human resources has been the most important impetus of China's rise. For the same reason, China's superpower status ultimately depends on what Professor Wu calls, I quote, a transition from a knowledge-closed nation into a knowledge-open nation. Now, the age of a knowledge economy, as Professor Wu characterized it, should be defined less by competition than by cooperation. Now, from the perspective of the outside world, I believe that Professor Wu's argument about the positive and engaging role of China in world affairs is very much in line with American interests. In virtually every important area of world affairs today, United States and the international community need China to play a proactive and constructive role, ranging from rebalancing the global economy to combating climate change, from North Korea to Iran, from Pakistan to Afghanistan, from energy security to environment protection, from counterterrorism to cybersecurity. Global peace and prosperity in the 21st century, of course, depends on many factors. Due to China's growing prominence in the world, I would argue that to a certain extent, it depends on whether China is treated as or acts like a solution or a problem. Now, this also raises an important question about the future political and economic trajectory of this country. Should we, the United States, worry about China's failure or worry about China's success? A failed China is everyone's nightmare. Just imagine prolonged chaos in this most populous nation, civil wars and ethnic fighting, environmental ecological degradation, epidemic and the large-scale health crisis, huge outflow of migration, and the so-called angry youth, the generation of young Chinese people from single-child family who are angry about the West, or so-called Western arrogance and the China bashing, and at the same time, some of them themselves become increasingly arrogant. Now, a successful China, in my view, can prevent these worst-case scenarios. But the problem is that the West, especially the United States, may not be ready to welcome China's success. Secretary Clinton said a couple of years ago that the United States and China can benefit from and contribute to the success of each other. But this view is hardly shared by the U.S. media and the U.S. Congress. Now, these are the fundamental and imminent issues that we China watchers overseas should address in the future. They have strong academic and policy implications. I want to conclude by congratulating Professor Huang Gang for your thought-provoking work from the perspective of the other side of the Pacific. As a leading proponent of Chinese optimism and Chinese exceptionalism, you help increase our knowledge and enhance understanding of the pressing issues and the long-term challenges that face China. Considered from an even broader context or perspective, your forward-looking book may also contribute to a growing international recognition that in the new global environment, we all must find novel ways to think about power and responsibility. Thank you very much.
While everyone is getting mic'd up, I've decided to stand up so that I can see people as they raise their hands and back. Let me remind you, first of all, as you can see, Professor Huang Gang's slides are very data-rich, and they will be posted on our website very quickly. Secondly, this meeting is on the record, so when you stand up, please do identify yourself, your name, and your affiliation, and then hopefully state a question succinctly. Feel free to direct it to any person up here except the translator. Please wait for a roving mic before you ask your question. I'm going to take the prerogative of the chair just to ask one opening question, and then we'll open it up to the audience. My question plays off a little bit what Cheng Li talked about, which is, Professor Hu, your analysis is extraordinarily wide-ranging, very multifaceted. But what I did not see in there was any conditionality you would attach based on evolution of the Chinese political system. In other words, do you have any particular assumptions built in about necessary developments at a political level in China in order for the rest of your analysis to play out as you have laid it out, for example, development of rule of law or whatever it may be? So my question is there a political component that is, and when I say political, I don't mean democracy or not, that's up to you, but I mean, is there a political component to China's capacity to become a superpower by the year 2020?
In 1997, I published articles. That title is The China's Reform Pursue the Economic Development. And now, if let me writing again, I will be mentioning about it, China's political reform for a homely society. That means I gave several points. Firstly, how to let the leader from a new from old generation to the new generation based on institutionalization. This is very successful in 2002. I gave a post-evaluation. Secondly, that means how to let leader to open learning, open innovation, especially create more and more ideas like Deng Xiaoping. This is very important. Example, 2003, I suggested hold a conference by the Premier Wen. I said we need to new conception of the development, not based on GDP, based on people center. As you know, the leader quickly to learn a lot of lessons from SARS crisis, developed the, I call the sixth generation of the development conception. As you know, the scientific development. The third, very important, we need to promote a reform mechanism for the making decision. I involved in 11 five-year program. Even this time, 12 five-year program, we funded. At least we take 11 times tips, more and more democracy, more and more life related, even the common people involved in to produce this 5-year program. This is a good case. I published a new article in our university journal last month, gave a detailed information. The last one, I think the China need to set up adaptive, flexible the mechanism to deal with like foreign, even the international affair, like the U.S. with the U.S., with Japan, flexible, this mechanism. Not, how to say, combine the principle and the flexible. This is the, our need reform. Very suitable for the China, especially for the China to quickly to respond the challenge, like a financial crisis, earthquake, and so on.
Thank you very much. Feel free to direct your questions to any of the individuals up here or all of them as you wish. Why don't we start off over here, and I'll work my way around the room. This gentleman in front, yes.
This is a question from Mr. Lardy, Rob Warren from DACOR. Okay. Martin Wolf wrote an article today in the Financial Times, which I think reinforces your argument. He concluded saying that China's in for a bumpy road, that the adjustment from a high investment to now more consumption is going to be a difficult transition.
I agree with Martin's column very, very much, and I think that's why I identified this financial. He didn't bring up the whole issue of financial repression. I'm trying to look at the underlying cause. Why did China come to have such a super elevated level of investment? I think financial repression is part of the story. I think the lack of, you know, an underdeveloped financial system is part of the reason. But I certainly agree with the conclusion, and that is a transition away from where they are today to where they need to be will be extremely challenging, and I think will be, as I said in my remarks, I think the most difficult challenge that China faces. And it's precisely because the only substitute for more, if you want to generate growth, if investment declines, is to generate more consumption. And I don't think it's going to be very easy to generate more consumption expenditure if you have a big decline in housing prices.
Let's see. Yes, back there. Yes.
Thank you very much. Akira Chiba from Japan. I am yet to read Professor Hu's book, but the impression I get from listening to his presentation is that we are arguing basically about China, which will live up to its size, both in geographical as well as demographical terms, which isn't not necessarily news to us. Probably what we want to hear more is about China's contribution to the world. And I'm very happy that Cheng Li has mentioned political freedom, but because if China is to become the world's largest democracy, that is going to be a tremendous contribution to the world. It's going to be a game changer of the whole situation in East Asia. But my question to Professor Hu concerns something much more myopic. It's about the GDP indicator that you use, because we all know that there are a lot of Japanese and American companies investing in China and producing in China, and if the end product is made in China, then it's counted as China's GDP. And I'm not aware of the size, the proportion of foreign investment in China that contributes to Chinese GDP. But I do have the impression that all the big GDPs elsewhere are producing, homegrown products that is not foreign investment. So how do you foresee China's future, the future of Chinese industry of shifting from foreign investment to its own homegrown industries?
I think the China take 30 years quickly from a closed economy, closed market, closed society, become the more and more open society, open economy. So we welcome the FDI into the China, even the take more and more good role, positive role. So we think about the FDI as a domestic interpreters. Even the FDI's innovation we call the domestic. This is very important. So the State Bureau statistics not published GNP or GDP. So we don't know what's between them gap. I think the not too much. This is secondly, I think the State Bureau cannot publish the FDI's share of the GDP. That's only publish the some data we can calculate FDI's share of the industry sector. That's only how to say scale interpreters. So we don't know exactly this ratio. But we continue to open outside, like all the country invest in China. Meanwhile, China need to invest in the global world. This is what I call the two legs for our policies.
Thank you. Nick, did you want to add anything to that, or are you fine? Okay. Over on the right-hand side here. Yes, sir. Dan.
I'm Randall Doyler. I work at the State Department in the Bureau of Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor. Professor Hu, you mentioned that two of the key points being principle and flexibility, but Mr. Chung Lee mentions the fact that any future progress or significant progress technologically, science-wise, you're going to have a freer society to allow people to work and to experiment. Since the 2008 Olympics, though, China has been increasingly cracking down on dissidents. And the younger generation, of course, hungers to connect itself more and more to the world. Now, have the recent last couple of years of the crackdowns on various religious groups, intellectuals, whatever, is this just a periodic thing because of the upcoming transition of power to Xi Jinping? Or is this becoming increasingly a new Chinese policy toward those who want to open up their society even more?
I think as I mentioned, the China very quickly to set up the clear the institutionalization of the leader from old generation to the new generation. 10 years, not 10 years, 2002, first time. But I think next year will be second time. I believe in the China. This is the reflects the China more and more. Transparency, more and more stabilization for the leaders, groups. This is the very key for the China in the future. Not only this institutionalization, but also how to institutionalize the leader, government officials, even the grass. Level the officials to listen to the people's voice. For example, like this time, 12-5-year program, NDRC set up that internet to accept the people, common people's suggestion, complaining, and other some ideas. Nearly the more than the 60,000 suggestion. Mostly reflect some Lati mentioned about the price of the rent increase, purchase very difficult to purchase a house and so on. So the government quickly to respond in this 5-year program. So I think the China how to gradually them step by step to set up, I call the democracy system even democracy experience or practice. This is very important.
Thank you. Miss, over here.
Katien from the Institute for Policy Studies, and I would like to direct a question to Professor Hu. So you mentioned China as a superpower with significant soft power. So I was wondering, what's your definition of soft power and what falls into that category? Is it the mature civil society that Mr. Chang Li talked about? And a related question would be, would China's increase of soft power be considered a power projection or threat by other nations? Thank you.
As you know, different scholars have a different definition of the soft power. As you know, first time to definition by Joseph Nye. From a China side perspective, I think the soft power relative to I call the hard power. I calculate, even make decision, make a calculate the comprehensive national power, including the eight kind of the resources, 23rd indicators, mostly we call the hard. The soft, we want to try to not only give a definition, try to calculate, like some indicators, like a published book, like a newspaper, like a medium, even the some science, technology, software, and so on. We want to give a classified. This is the ideas. That means like culture or knowledge. As I know, this is the typical global public goods. Give a split over other person, other country. Not a street, other country. This is the reflects the China need to contribution, knowledge contribution, culture contribution, and so on. So very general or broadly, this is my definition or calculate some ideas. Okay.
Your questions, your answers are generating a lot of questions back here.
Okay.
We'll turn to economics, I think, here. Very lucky with this question.
I'm Peter Battaglia. I'm with Johns Hopkins SAIS. Question for Huan Gang. In one of the features of the very benign picture of China as a superpower with special characteristics in 2030 is a small gap between the rich and the poor. If that objective is to be realized, we need a big and early reversal of recent trends. Income and wealth inequality in China have become very unequal in the last two decades. And even though the government has made the reversal of that a priority in the 12th five-year plan, we don't see the beginnings of a reversal yet. How and when do you expect this projection to begin to be true?
I'm an expert on the China regional disparity. We funded the China regional disparity based on different indicators have different pictures or conclusions. Based on the per capita GDP, constant price, curve, coefficient since the reform decline until the 1990. After that, increase continue to the 2004. But now, we find it since the 2004 continue decline. We are hope by 2030 will be continue. This is the first indicator. Second indicator is we use INGO coefficient. For the region, for the urban and the rural area, we funded since the reform. Since the reform, continue convergences. We don't use the per capita income or per capita expenditure. Why? INGO coefficient coincide us, as you know, different region, different urban and rural area have different price. So how to understand it? Third indicators, we call the hairs, like a life expectancy, continued convergences, even the urban and the rural area. Another we call the education, based on the average school year for the adults, different region, even urban and the rural area, continue convergences. But as you know, this problem, equality, very important, very tough. We need to take next 10 years or even the next 20 years deal this problem.
Thank you. Chunger, Nick, did you?
Yeah. I have a question. I'm sorry to interrupt others.
I thought you wanted to comment on this.
Oh, you're sure. Then jumping in the queue on the question. That always inspired by Peter. And as Ken mentioned in the beginning, that you are always ahead of time and to detecting the problems China face earlier than most of people like us. And also you have been involved, as you mentioned, that the participating policy-making process. Now, with a new generation of leadership coming, and I would ask you that what suggestions you would give them, or what serious problem you think they should deal with in a very serious way. Now, let me mention several areas. One is the political area. Do you think anti-corruption is very, very important? And what mechanisms should be introduced? How to deal with the state monopoly? This is widely corruption by the SASAC company or state-owned enterprises. This is on the political front. On the economic area, how to deal with, what do you think the major challenges the country should face, whether you should have a tax for the property, how to deal with the possible property bubble, and if we think that's a bubble.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to cut this off this week.
I try to answer. In this my book, last chat, I gave some target, some ideas, even the target, even the grand strategy suggestion, not only for the current leaders, even for the next leaders, next generation leaders. Recently, we not only stop in 2020, we want to go ahead in 2030.
But what about now, the problems, serious
challenges? Okay. I need to distinguish between the short term, medium term, and the long term. Okay? This is very important. So the short term, I think the 25-year program gave very clear the answer. If you are detailed to read it, you find some answer. Okay? Very general. So we don't talk. But you are mentioning about the important problem like corruption. I think a very serious problem. As I mentioned, a big challenge, a political challenge for the leaders. This is the CPC, the biggest challenge. As you know, they have over than 60 years for a ruling party. The biggest challenge, biggest series, that means mass, okay? So this is not only Chairman Mao face this problem, but also next generation, same problem. That means how to control some of the officers' corruption, how to let them play more and more hand for the service people. This is, as you know, not only for the China, but also the global, the same problem. We need to further to our practice. Okay.
Okay, thank you. Back there.
Thank you. Dong Huiyu with the China Press. My question is for Professor Hu and Mr. Lardy. And in the past couple of days, some American experts like Robini and Soros expected that China may have a hard landing because China has lost the opportunity, has lost the window opportunity to control the inflation. What's your estimation about that? My second question
I'm going to limit each person to one question because we have a lot of people who have been putting up hands. Okay, thank you. So the issue is, has China lost its window of opportunity to control inflation and therefore is it potentially facing a hard landing?
I have last 30 years experience to analyze China not only economic growth but also economic fluctuation. But this time, I think if I compare the 1994 and 1988, you don't worry about it. The China have government have a good capacity to control. We call the capacity for the stabilization macroeconomy. So this is why recently we don't analyze this. Even the research, this problem. I believe in the leader can do it. Even the do the best. Good example, like 2009, G20, most developing country, negative growth. That's only China, India, and Indonesia. The China reached to the 9.2%. This is a good example. So I believe in the Chinese leader to quickly, to flexible, to deal with this serious short-term problem or challenges.
Nick, do you want to
come? Let me just add to that. I think I basically agree with An Gang. I completely disagree with what Mr. Soros said yesterday. I think he's completely wrong. China has been gradually tightening monetary policy for more than a year and a half. I think it's been relatively successful. They now have the rate of growth of broad money down to 15%, which has been in the past consistent with a fairly rapid rate of economic growth and price stability. Furthermore, if you look at the headline 5.5% inflation that was reported yesterday, it's 11 point something, I think 11.7 for food, and 2 point something, close to 3, but under 3 for non-food items. So this is the inflation that has been generated in recent months, or since starting late last year, has been generated primarily in the food sector. Part of that reflects global food inflation. But I think in China, we've seen in the past, when food inflation ticks up, you get a very rapid supply response. Farmers start producing more. More food comes to market. I think it's very, very likely by the third quarter that inflation will be below 5%, and by the end of the year we'll be heading down probably something closer to 4. So I think the hard landing scenario is a very low probability because China has been gradually bringing monetary growth under control, slowing it down, as I say, for more than a year and a half.
Thank you. Sir, over here. Second row, Bobby. Right.
I'm Viren Prakash, retired civil servant from India. And my one point that I want to make is that if you had another scenario in your analysis where instead of the growth rate being 7.5, which appears to be rather optimistic, if it was 5%, what would be the situation? I think that would be of great interest to us. But having said that, throwing cold water on optimism or exceptionalism. What I want to ask you is, post 2030, if your analysis works out, are you looking at a bipolar world? This is a political question, because India is interested in that, or you are imagining something close to working for creating a world government. Because unless the world is to be divided into two powers, then that's one situation. But if you are, since you are talking of cooperation, I'm also wondering whether this cooperation comes from Buddhism or Confucianism or Maoism.
Excuse me, we've got to move on to this, so if we can answer your question. So my question is this,
that without conceptualizing a world government, do you think the world is going to be divided between the United States and China?
Yeah. Okay. So the question is this leading to a bipolar world? Let me put it in terms that we're more familiar with here, or a multipolar world. Okay.
I think the in the 21st century, there will be more and more integration for the region, for the global. But it's difficult to produce a world government. So the China like to contribution, even participate actively, participate in the global governance. Like this time, the Chinese leaders to participate in the G20 conference summit to support how to let the world economy and growth, even the investment, quickly to recovery. This is a good example. So we need to continue to go ahead to promote international cooperation.
Thank you. This lady in the back row, I think, or second to last row over here.
I'm Sarah Beeson with Stimson Center. My question is with the issue of resources and how the Chinese optimalism, resources is key to that and allowing for that high-speed growth to continue. And so China has been reaching out for rights and access to minerals and other energy sources in Latin America, Africa, and even Afghanistan. And many within the international community are uncomfortable with this aggressive policy and tendency. How do you foreshadow that the outcome of that interaction and how that would have an impact on the Chinese optimism that you saw?
This time, the 25-year program, original to want to introduce very important indicators we call the energy efficiency. That means not only energy efficiency, resources efficiency, including 12 kind of the minor resources, including coal, energy, and so on, as a very important quantitative indicator to promote efficiency use these minor resources. But in fact, the provincial level cannot collect these indicators because these indicators not only including the local produce, local consumption, including import, export. So from China side, we need to address even the continue to set up what we call the resources saving society. This is a very important basic policy or strategy. Secondly, we need to utilize international resources based on international price. This is reflect the China, the resources prices domestic will be step by step convergences to the international price. This is a reflect the China step, saving energy, saving resources, even the save other some resources.
Thank you. Here, this lady. Sorry, I know some of you have had your hands up waving avidly, but a lot of you have, so I'm jumping around, and I'm sorry if I don't get to everybody. Please.
So, hi, my name is Shiran Shen, and I'm a student at Swarthmore College and also a research intern at Institute for Policy Studies. And so I actually have two questions for Dr. Hu, but since time is limited, so just please feel free to comment on either one of them. So my first question is, as China rises quickly, how does China deal with the security dilemma engendered in its neighboring countries? And my second question is, how about the challenges posed by the skewed male to female sex ratio in China? Thanks.
I used to teach at Swarthmore College, and let me say, this is, I would have known she was from Swarthmore.
Firstly, the China not only advocate the homely society, but also advocate the homely Asia. So this is a very important principle for us. I call the China need to utilize the 天时地利 and 人和. The 地利 means the set up a very important framework deal with the neighbor country or neighbor, economy. I find it neighbor economy including 24, including the Hong Kong Macau. China now quickly become number one or number two or number three trader, even the investor. So this is the how to set up a mutual, the win-win, the game, very important. Last question. Yeah, this is a big problem for the China. But if based on the World Bank database, UNDP database, you find it, the China very successful for the education, health, and so on. But in fact, we need to continue to deal with this problem.
Thank you. Back here, sir.
Yeah, Bill Jones from Executive Intelligence Review. Professor Hu, I haven't read your book, so I'm just taking it from the graphs that you showed. It seemed like it was a very smooth development, very linear development over the next 20, 30 years. But the world we're living in is far from smooth. The economy is much more like the weather. We're getting tornadoes in areas where they never appeared before. We're getting earthquakes much larger than anybody ever imagined. Now, China's been able to work its way through the latest jolt in 2007, thanks to the reserves that had been accumulated during the period when they were the low labor or the
almost out of time. I'm going to ask you a question, please.
And was able to maintain some kind of a smooth, relatively smooth growth period. But if something happens, like if the dollar loses in value, if it goes through the tank, if Greece has to default on its debt, causing this, what possibility does China have dealing with this situation alone? Seems to me that they would have to create something with the other nations to create a new situation for the world rather than have the capability themselves of mastering this crisis in the way that they did in 2007.
Thank you.
Have you taken that into consideration?
I think you're right. Take example like China last 5 years, accumulatively import $5 trillion. Based on conservative estimate, there will be create a job for the global, for the other countries, more than 40 million jobs. Okay? But the next 5 years, conservative, I estimate at least more than $10 trillion import accumulatively. There will be create at least 100 million jobs. This is our contribution to promote the win-win. Even China now, number two importer. Perhaps next 3 years or 4 years, the China quickly become number one importer. This is I call the China market contribution, even the China market create job, including the U.S.
Thank you. Way in back, the far back corner over there.
Thank you. Okay. Rob Colorina, AIC Investments. Question is more on the commercial side for the professor and then for Nick. With respect to things like standards, if you're going to be a superpower, things like standards, product quality, transparency, I think some of this recent with the these IPOs, how important is that for the C-level executives and board members? Are they, is this next generation really taking that into account?
As you know, the China government pay attention recently for the food goods or products, even the export safe. This is a problem. Next 5 years, based on 12 5 years, we'll address this monetary examination and so on. So I think the China need to from pursue the quantity of the economic growth to the quality of the economic growth. So I believe the China businessman thinking about it. This is not only for the business interest, but also have to give the social contribution, social responsibility.
I mean, my brief answer is that I think that 20, 30 years ago, there was a huge gap between standards in China and standards in international business. And the gap is closing. It's still there in some areas. It's maybe gotten worse, but I think in general the trajectory is good. But it's going to take a long time to converge. And you see it in domestic issues on issues like food quality. You see it in financial markets. But if you looked overall, I think I would argue that in financial markets they've come a long way to, you know, moving their regulatory standards to those that are consistent with global standards. They're participating in the Basel process. Bank capital adequacy standards are going up. The provisioning standards are going up. The risk weighting is being adjusted in a more conservative way, just as we're doing in the U.S. and most of the rest of the world. So I think it's on balance, a positive story.
I know there are a lot more questions. We, unfortunately, are out of time. I want to thank both of our commentators, Lee Chung and Nick Lardy, and especially Professor Huang Gong, both for providing us with this great book and for coming all the way to the United States to participate in this event this afternoon. Please join me in thanking them.